tonight's speakers, who is Jessica.
Thank you.
There you go.
Hi, my name is Jessica, and I'm a recovering addict.
Hi.
I'm going to try this whole seated thing. I can't make any promises. I'm American, so I could stand up at any time. You know, I was thinking like, wow, we are in the absolute epicenter of one of the greatest cities in the world. And it is Friday night. You know, and I think it's time to get the party started a little bit. In the way that only NA can. So if everybody would join me and hug the person to the left and or right of you. You know, I always kind of feel like sometimes we can become a little morbidly serious, a little too somber, and for me, NA meetings are very often are a celebration. You know, we celebrate people that are just coming in. We celebrate and welcome people who are just coming back. You know, the most important people, the newcomers. We celebrate people who are picking up one of the many multicolored tags. And we celebrate that we've found each other. And I was having a conversation with somebody on the phone today, and they're talking about moving from here to Chicago, and I was just saying to them, you know, I've moved a few times in recovery, and it is a highly underestimated challenge in recovery. You know, it ranks right up there with death and recovery, you know, illness and recovery, because moving is rough. And I can speak from my own experience that the very first thing that happens is that you walk in, you sit in a meeting, and although everything is pretty much the same, the very first thing that I think is, you are doing this so wrong. Everything that's happening is so wrong. This is not the order of things. This is not the way things should be going. You know, nobody hugged me or whatever it is. And for me, it's my disease taking root in its favorite plaything, which is disqualification. You know, the way that I can isolate myself from human connection. And, you know, I've been able to move, those moves were culminations of lifelong dreams, and they were cause for great celebration. And by coming to this new city, and my most successful move to date definitely was to London. I was very fortunate. My circumstances were that I moved here, and I wasn't working right away, and I was able to throw myself into the program, and basically I made 90-90. I went to meetings, I raised and shared at every single meeting until thankfully I got to this one, and I was so relieved that I could just sit down and shut the fuck up. But I raised my hand at every meeting, and I said, I'm new, I just moved here, you know, from New York, and I really need to connect with people, I really need to make this my home. And the Fellowship of London is fantastic. You know, well done. I've never been so embraced and so cared for in all the places that I moved, you know. And I went to lots of meetings. I went out with people after the meetings. I'm very fortunate in the relationship I have. I have a lot of autonomy in my marriage. I can kind of do what I want, say what I want for the most part, get away with what I want for the most part. And, you know, and just kind of really was able to throw myself into, and I got a home group right away, and it's those basics, you know. And Where I first got clean, and in the States where I've lived mostly, there was something that was always said at the beginning of every meeting, and they were what we call the 8 suggestions. And it's what I refer to with new sponsees as step zero. And they were suggestions like, make at least 90 meetings in 90 days. Get phone numbers and use them. You know, get a home group, get a sponsor. Come early and stay late. That was a trick. It took me a while to do that. I mean, I couldn't show up anywhere on time, let alone early. But, you know, come early and stay late. You know, build up a network of women, of people, of men, whatever it is that, you know, whatever you're into or not into. Make a network of that. you know, I kind of went right back to those basics for me. You know, I got a home group right away, and it wasn't like I walked into this meeting. You know, I went into the Sunday night Chiswick meeting and was like, oh, I feel at home. This is amazing. It was on a Sunday night. I could ride my bicycle. I lived in Chiswick. It was at the right time, at the right place. I don't need to complicate it anymore. You know, and so that was my home group. And I got a commitment at that home group, and I was the greeter. And I just want to stand out, and I want to be able to be the one that greets people. What better way for me to meet people than standing at the door? And, you know, I collected loads of women's phone numbers, most of which I didn't call. 17 and a half years clean when I moved here, and feeling like I had about 10 days. I don't know if anybody else can identify with this, but when you get those numbers and you start looking at them and then you start thinking, oh, I don't know, it's too early, it's too late, they're probably working, I don't know what to say, I mean, do they really want to hear? I mean, all of that noise, that volume went right back up again. You know, and I'd be like, Jessica, just send a text, let's ice break this, you know, one step at a time here. And kind of reach out and establish that connection. And that battle has been really tough. It was a big shift for me to come somewhere and not have a network and not have a few people I could see on a relatively regular basis that have known me for my entire recovery. And it required a lot of vulnerability on my part and a lot of just standing up and saying, I'm here, see me. You know, and that doesn't always come easy to me. And so I went to all these meetings and I went and got service, which was interesting. I went to H&I, and I had very explicit directions from my sponsor that I was not moving here to run shit. And so I went to H&I, and then I came home, and I called my sponsor back in New York, and I was like, you're not going to believe what's happening here. It sounds crazy. And I was like, ah! And she's like, all right, calm down. Tell me what's going on. And so I told her, and she's like, oh, no, you've got to fix that. And again, a lot of that was just, you're not doing it the way that I've always accustomed it being done. So therefore, you're not doing it right, you know. Luckily, I know how to play the long game. If Service and Narcotics Anonymous has taught me nothing else, it is a level of diplomacy, and that kindness and that compassion and that love actually gets a lot more done than self-righteousness, anger, and resentment. So I wasn't supposed to come over here and I was supposed to be a greeter, right? And maybe just take a meeting into a detox and just lay low. So 3 years later, I'm now the chair of H&I. It's how I do. Some things just can't be helped, I guess. Maybe on the next round of steps, right? And I love it. You know, I really love it. It service has always been a very consistent part of my recovery story. I get far more out of the service I do than I feel like I give on any given day. And I've heard, you know, all I can do is do what Shelley asked me to do, which is come here and share my experience, strength, and hope. I'm not here how to tell you to work your program, how to work your steps, anything like that at all. If something I say offends you, I have no control over that, right? But I can tell you that at different stages of my life, regardless of the many, many, many commitments, I'm talking working full-time, going to school full-time, traveling to universities in two different states while I was going to school full-time and working full-time, doing service in Narcotics Anonymous. It's never been too far for me to drive. It's never been too much for me to do. Because this is how my recovery works. And very often when I share about doing service, I get a very long line of people coming up to me, very well-intentioned, I understand. And they're just coming to list to me all the reasons why they can't do service. I'm gonna ask you, if you feel the need to do that, to pause. Because there's some people behind the line that actually wanna maybe come ask me how they can do service. And I'd really like to speak to them. And then I'll speak to you after. You know, and I just say that because there is no excuse for me not to show up for my recovery and to not carry the message of Narcotics Anonymous. This program saved my life. This was the last stop in town. Everywhere else wasn't telling me, keep coming back. complete opposite. You're not welcome here anymore. You're too, I mean, when the people you're using with say, you know what, you bring a little too much crazy to the party, that's not a good sign. You know, newspapers were touting how unacceptable I was, you know, and how horrible I was. And I was calling at friends' houses, and their parents were answering the phone and saying, please don't call here anymore and stay away from my daughter. Stay away from my son. My family had changed the locks on the house, not because they didn't love me, because they lived in fear of what kind of physical, emotional, and financial pain I would rain down upon them. Now, I may look like I am very put together now, and I am, but I did not crawl into Narcotics Anonymous looking or feeling or talking like this. I dragged in a very empty carcass with just the faintest glimmer of light left in it, more like a smolder, like a tendril of smoke from a cigarette, is what I dragged in here. And I was so hopeless that there was going to be any other way for me to live, any other way for me to get through the pain of living life on its own terms, that there would be any other way for me to be able to exist in this skin that was wound so tight on my body that I just wanted to shred it off. You know, and so coming to Narcotics Anonymous revolutionize my existence. And sometimes when I say that, it's easy for me to think that that was a really quick process. But revolutions are typically not really very quick. And revolutions are typically not bloodless. And my revolution of recovery has not been bloodless. It has not been quick. It has been hard won. There has been success. There has been failure. I was reading the Just for Today, and it was talking about success, failure, shame, and all of that. And I thought, you know, this is what my recovery has been a lot about. And the last couple years have really about, for me, have been a state of deployment. And what I mean by that is that I've been spending most of my recovery working, right? Doing service, working, step work, working, sponsees, working, fumbling around, trying to use the steps, sometimes getting it right, sometimes getting it wrong, then getting to a place where I'm able to utilize the steps in my everyday life, like first step, right? When life starts to happen, on any given day, my first step is just a pause. It's just, whoa, I'm not going to speak. I'm not going to act. I'm just going to sit here for a few seconds. I'm going to count them off. 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. And now I'm going to go talk to somebody and ask them what I should do. On any given day, that's what my first step is. Because my disease when I first got here was like, I want to get high. I want to get high, I want to get high, I want to get high. All day, that was what was playing on the loop. You know, this is great. I'm going to do this for a little while, just until I can get out of trouble. And then, you know, it's going to be that time. It's on. And white knuckling it was painful. You know, it was really painful. So when I was able to start working the steps and applying them in my life, it really transformed my human experience. And I know that sounds like some hippy-dippy kind of stuff, but it really transformed my human existence, how I moved through the world, what state I woke up in, and what state I felt like 5 minutes after I woke up, how I was able to connect with other human beings, how I was able to make meetings, how I was able to start to talk to other people, because I didn't do that when I first came here. I sat way in the back of the meeting, had my hat pulled down, cocked to the side a little bit, you know, and sent off like major vibrations that were just like, do not come close to me. Do not come anywhere near me. And it took me a long time to just step into the light enough to kind of be seen in the shadows, to kind of just peek my head out and say, I'm here. And then to admit, I don't know what I'm doing. And on any given day, that's my first step, is I don't know what I'm doing. I know there's a problem, but I don't know how to fix it. And the second step tells me that I don't have to know how to fix it. I'm not alone. You know, that I can be restored to sanity. Can be, not always, can be restored to sanity. Some sort of sane thinking, some sort of like not state of emergency all the time. And what I mean by state of emergency is like I lived most of my life with I've got to make this decision, I got to make it right now, I got to do this, I got to do it right now, I got to break up with them, I got to not break up with them, I got to get a job, not get the job, put in the application, not put in the application. It was just like constant. And I remember I had an old sponsor who just, I don't know what I was going through, probably breakup. And I was like, and she just was like, isn't it wonderful that you don't have to make this decision tonight? That had never crossed my mind. I've got to make this decision, I'm going to make it right now. You know, so that restoration of sanity, that pause, that first step, that coming to believe that quite possibly I can be restored to some sanity, that a power greater than me could offer me some options, some restoration. And that power greater than me on any given day still is another recovering addict, right? The ultimate weapon, it says in the basic text, another recovering addict. And listen, it's not always just any recovering addict. I'm going to be real with you. I've got a tight-knit kind of like group, you know, I've got like a top five, right? I've got a top five people. And today, those top five people, not any one of them is a co-signer. Okay, I used to have at least one, if not two, co-signers in the top five. So these are the people that when I want to do what I want to do, when I want to do it, I call you. And then you say, yeah, let's do it. It's on. Welcome. Do it. Do it. Do it. I don't have any of those in my top five now. The people I have in my life now are people whose experience I value, whose lives I value, who basically almost pretty much meet the same requirements as my sponsor, who are living a life that I'd like to live, who have some principles that I'd like to have, and who aren't afraid to tell me about me. And that's not easy. You know, I'm not the easiest person for people to feel comfortable to come up to and tell me about myself. And I've tried working on that any which way I can figure, but I can't seem to just shake that, whatever that is, that kind of intimidates people. But trust me, I don't have a problem with you telling me about myself. Because I need that. And I always say that if you don't want to hear about yourself, don't come sit next to me. You know, because that's the kind of friendship I offer as well. You know, it's a two-way street. And so I call that really select group. And that doesn't mean that I don't call newcomers in my life, that I don't invite new people. I have an open door policy on my life. But I've spent some time cultivating, especially since moving here, this past 3 years, the challenge has been cultivating that top five. The people that are on the ready on the same time zone as me that I can call when things are going down. And things go down, quite frankly, a lot less often than they used to, but I still need my top five. You know, and so when I'm able to do that and I get restored to some sanity, I get that power greater than me, and sometimes it's stuff that I read, sometimes it comes from the God of my understanding, you know, my higher power, sometimes it comes from some beautiful guided meditation, anything that restores me to sanity. Are you giving me the...
No.
Okay.
It's the phone.
Restoring me to sanity. Works. And, you know, that is the only state where I'm functioning at enough of a level that I can make a decision, right? I can do a third step. I can make a decision to turn my will and my life over to the care of God as I understand him, it, whatever you want to call it, right? And to make that decision means that I've got to take action. This is now I'm leaving the realm of theoretical. I'm leaving the realm of talking smack with my top five, right? How I'm going to do it. Today's the day. Maybe tomorrow's the day. Maybe next week's the day. Maybe today's the day. This is what I'm going to do, or I'm going to do that, or I'm going to do this, and I'm, well, just one more time, and then, you know, I'm ready to make my decision, and I'm ready to take some action, and I'm ready to try something other than my will, which is just simply my way of doing things. Stuart said it. I'm going to paraphrase. His best decisions earned him a seat in Narcotics Anonymous. And I got to tell you, when we first get here, it's not a booby prize. It doesn't feel that way. I now do feel that way. But it didn't feel that way when I got here. I was not a grateful recovering addict. I couldn't understand people that said that. How could you be grateful to be an addict? To have to live this life, have to come to this place on a, you know, on a Friday night in the basement of a shelter. What's happening here? Now I feel that, and I'll get to that later. But you know, once I'm able to get those coping skills in place where I'm no longer making decisions based in a state of emergency, right? And just volume 10 all the time, and I'm able to get a little bit of a pause in my life, I'm able to just operate enough, right, and start to move through my life, do things like get a job and not quit the same day. That's what I do. I'm able to actually have a phone conversation with my mother without losing my mind. Early recovery stuff. Not so early recovery stuff. I'm able to, you know, just start to connect to other human beings in a meaningful way, or at least in a relatively not as harmful way as I used to. And then for me, you know, the fourth step and the fifth step and the six, seven, eight, nine, the work that I did in those steps, and that's really what has been in, I'm talking about deployment earlier, is deploying what I learned in those steps on a whole new level. You know, the Just for Today was talking about shame and about resentment, about success and about failure. And this last couple years has been about pushing out beyond the mist of accepting my assets and defects, pushing beyond the mist of not just repeating the same behavior, and beyond the mist of just saying, I'm sorry, making amends, and even beyond the mist of forgiveness, not just getting it, but actually extending it. And when I say that is that all that stuff was really valuable to me, and I really needed to do that. I needed to learn how to extend forgiveness to other people. I needed to learn how to ask for my defects of character to be removed, right? Because I what I like to do is try to fix, manage, and control. And by doing that, right, I found myself back in a state of emergency. So what that meant for me is that every time I felt like I was about to behave like I always used to behave or do something or say something that was hurtful, I would just try to like grab it into a bottle, put it in, screw the top on, and hold it there. You know, I'm just not going to say anything. I'm not going to do anything. And that worked for a little while. I tried the removing myself from situations and where in which I was prone to act out. And that was cool for a while, too. I mean, that stuff works. But at some point, I had to get, like, step out into the world, the whole entire world, which meant places where I'm prone to act out. Family Christmas. Jobs, coworkers, colleagues, managers. Supervisors, mm-hmm. Relationships. I mean, I thought I was pretty well, and then I got in a relationship. Whew. I thought I didn't have any defects left, and then I got in a relationship. And every time, it was like, ooh. So, you know, I mean, I was able to take some time off of some of those things, but at some point, I had to step back into the ring of life. And that's where I finally realized that it's not about fixed managing and controlling. It's no longer about being good enough, having enough of a first step. I used to beat myself up. What's wrong? Why isn't this working? I must not have a good enough fourth step, or fifth step, or first step, or second step. I must not be working the program right. And again, working myself up into that state of emergency. And the reality is that the whole purpose of the 12 steps is not to get me to some blissed out state of living. That's why I was using drugs. The purpose of the 12 steps is allow me to become the person that can live in the entire world and take some hits. To learn what it's like to be rejected and get back up. To take some risks and succeed and stand tall and be proud of that. To take risks and fail and stand tall and be proud of that. You know, and the last couple years has been a lot of that, taking that to the next level. And I've been doing it in every area of my life. And the most challenging is that about 2 years ago, I decided that I wanted to explore what I wanted to be when I grew up again. Right? I have early midlife crisis. And was like, I don't know what I want to be when I grow up. I knew that I was unhappy doing the career that I had been doing for the last 14 or 15 years. And I thought, you know, I tried it every which way to get it to work. I tried to be grateful enough for it, right? Because I would say to myself, you should be grateful that you have this job. You should be grateful that you have this opportunity. You should be grateful you should be making this money. And I worked on that for years. And you know what? It didn't work. So then I tried moving to a new city and working for a new company. I bet it was the company. You know, I've tried to fix me, and that hasn't seemed to make it work. So maybe it was the company. If I find another company but do the same thing, it will be different. Right? And this is where I start to hear myself saying, just one more time. This time will be different. Those are always red light indicator sentences for me. And so I found myself doing it again, and then working for another company and doing it again, until finally I was able to surrender to something that had been staring me in the face for 15 years. That this work that I was doing didn't match up to who I really was on the inside. And I had been saying it here and there to people. I had been saying, friends who were teachers, they would be like envious of my income, and I'd be envious of the work that they were doing. I said, listen, man, you're changing lives. What am I doing? Changing the world, one millionaire's second home at a time? I don't think so. You know, and I would say comments like that, and I knew I meant it, but I didn't know how deep that actually sit inside of me. And that was scary. To say, you know what, I want to figure out what I want to be when I grow up. And I started flipping through all the different things that I thought I was qualified to do, I thought I would be good at, you know, I thought that would actually be helping other people. Because I knew that's what was driving me, that I wanted to do something that would be able to touch other people, help people in a truly meaningful way. And so I started, you know, just kind of going through, like, I could be a teacher, I could be a therapist, I could be this, I could be that, blah, 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 you know. And going through it all, but what the difference was, instead of just it worrying around, right, getting to that state of emergency and then not doing anything and continuing on doing what I've always done, I actually sat there and talked to other people, had calm, rational conversations. I began to actually like list out pros and cons, things that I had done through step work for so many other situations in my life, about why this would be good, that would work, that wouldn't be good work, researching into how long it would take, how much money it would cost, all that kind of stuff, so that I could actually just make an informed decision. And I say it like that because, as silly as that sounds, that was kind of momentous for me. Yeah. You know, we talked about revolutionizing my life. I mean, 17, 18 years later, like, the revolution was like alive, you know? It was like, it's happening now, I'm finally getting it. And what I wind up choosing to do, I'm so excited, and I've been spending the last 6 months just working on building my business, and I'm able to, you know, I'm able to be in what I call the love business, right? Like, I get to help people find love and keep love, and I can't think of anything that's, I don't know, it just gives me chills when I think about that. It just, if I can get to the end of my life and say that I was able to help some people do that, that would be amazing. And that whole process has been the most thrilling and the most terrifying thing I have ever done in my entire life. Talk about vulnerability. Stepping out and being seen. I'm not hiding behind a company. I'm not hiding behind products. It's all me. And like, I've decided to do this in a way that is authentically me. Like, I'm not making this whole life change, right? I'm not going through this midlife crisis. I'm not giving up all these things so that I can wind up doing work that I can't stand in a few years. So as well as choosing to do something that I've always wanted to do, I'm going to be me. And I can't speak to anybody else, but there's some really terrifying moments of that for me. Going out into social media as me. All my personality, all my attitude, all my assets, all my defects, all my failures, all my successes. And all of the noise that goes with that in my head, the chatter. I mean, I caught myself at one point thinking what some boyfriend from 10 years ago is sitting there in his house on social media thinking about what I'm doing. I mean, the insanity, right? Like, of one, caring, them even probably even see, noticing. I mean, their self-obsession started to kick up. And that's okay, because it doesn't mean that I haven't worked enough. I don't have a good enough 8th and 9th step. I don't have a good enough 10th step. This is about just accepting who I am, that my head goes there. That I throw up blocks, right? That I am not only my greatest enemy, I am also my best friend today. that those two very different things exist in the same body at the same time. And so that when this stuff goes down, I can just kind of say, thanks for sharing, and keep it moving. You know, I didn't realize how hard it was for me to ask for help still until I had to ask people for help. And it was a silly kind of little thing. But I was, for 2 days, like, nobody's going to help me. I'm not worthy of help. I was caught up in anger and resentment and fear before anybody had the opportunity to reject me. I mean, all of that came up. And then I asked one person to help me, and they didn't come through. And that next day, I was kind of on the floor a little bit about it. And I mean, in my head, angry, all this stuff, right? I was like, I can't believe I put myself out there, asked them for help, all the things that I've done for them, right? Because that's where it gets dangerous. Everything I've done for you, you know? And then next thing you know, I was like, and everything this person happened to me in the program, and everything I've done for Narcotics Anonymous, you know, I'm going to take a big step back. You people are going to be so sorry when I'm gone. So after an hour of that, which was exhausting, I just, you know, had to kind of first step, right? Surrender. That person didn't help me. I asked for help, and I was rejected. I need to get back up. I need to come to believe in the power greater than me that can restore me to sanity, that when I ask for help, I have all this other historical evidence of being helped, that one person doesn't negate the hundreds of people that have helped me. And then I sat there, and I asked literally hundreds of people to help me, and hundreds of people helped me. Now, there was definitely some moments of, but that one person didn't help me. And then I had to literally go, but look at the hundreds of people that helped you. Because this is where my head goes. And it's not because I'm less than. It's not about getting good enough or better enough or well enough or any of that. It's just who I am and how my mind works. And that's okay. I can work with that, actually. I can work with that. And so I say all this, and I'm gonna start to wind it down. You know, this pushing through shame, right? And it may not sound like shame, but when I get into a place of I'm not enough, I'm not worthy of help, for me, that is coming from a place of shame. That's coming from a very historical base of not getting help when I needed help when I was a child. And I'm not going to turn this into a child moment, and it, definitely not an inner child moment. But I'm saying that stuff goes way back, and it doesn't get fixed overnight. And when people ask me why I keep coming to Narcotics Anonymous now over 20 years later, it's because, darling, I got a whole lot more work to do. I need to keep coming back. Because this program isn't done with me yet. And I meet people all the time and I want what they have. So that tells me that I can still get so much more out of this program, that there's so much more freedom. I'm just, honestly, I feel like I'm not saying it's gonna take you as long as it did for me, but it's taken me so long to get to this place of really feeling like I'm standing in the sun, opening up like that flower it talks about in the 11th step, like that I am truly welcoming love into my life and vulnerability. And that word no longer is a bad word to me. I no longer think of vulnerability as a weakness. It's my superpower, actually. Because when I crack open my chest, when I open up that hole one rib at a time, I do create this void, and through that void, through that vulnerability in my chest, pain, rejection, anger, suffering, and the haters can most certainly get in. But it's through that same hole that love can get in. That all these people that want to help me, that want to love me, who want to accept me can get in. And it's the only way that the love I have inside of me can actually get out. And so I'm willing to take the good with the bad today. And I know that the haters are just gonna hate. And that's okay. I don't have to worry about that. These are not the droids you're looking for. You know, and once I got to that place of being like, you know what, I don't really care what you think of me. I'm actually just really now I'm at the place where, like, not only do I not care what you think about me, not only am I not dependent, my self-worth, on what you think I'm worth, I am my own best friend. I think I'm good enough. I think I'm worthy. And that is huge stuff. Stephen came up to me earlier, and I was like, I don't know what I'm going to share today. I'm like all over the place. And if you're new and none of that made sense to you, the most beautiful thing about Narcotics Anonymous, especially in a great city like this, is that there are 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 10 meetings a day, and every meeting is a different set of players and a different cast on the stage. So if you didn't identify with anything that I had to share, if it didn't resonate with you, keep coming back. Because tomorrow night, somebody might say something that's going to save your life. Yeah. I know that I need the only thing I can share is my truth and a genuine, heartfelt message. And I really do believe I left that there for you tonight. Thanks for letting me share.